Hello, my name's Craig Barker, and I'm the head of public engagement at the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney. Welcome to Object Matters, the podcast of the museum. This podcast series explores the relationship between our guests and a museum collection item. And for this particular episode, I'm especially thrilled to be joined by the brick man himself, Ryan McNaught. Ryan's been a great friend of the museum over many, many years now. He's a certified Lego professional, the only one in the Southern Hemisphere and only one of 21, we believe. and since 2019, Ryan's also been a judge on Channel 9's Lego Masters Australia program, along with Hamish Blake. It's a real pleasure. Thank you for finding time in your very busy schedule, Ryan. Lovely to have you on Object Matters.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Now, Ryan, you have, of all the people I know, you have the world's coolest job.
No complaints. Your job's pretty awesome too, to be honest. As you know, a big fan of the museum for a long period of time. So, yeah, I'm very lucky that I get to play with Lego all day.
Well, could I begin by asking you how you first got into Lego? I'm assuming you played with it as a child, like the rest of us. But at what point do you go from that childhood passion to actually making it a profession?
Yeah, look, interesting question. I did, obviously, as a kid, I loved Lego. I thought Lego was the answer. And then it was about probably 13 or 14 when it kind of became uncool. You know, it wasn't the done thing as a teenager. But fortunately for me, my mum had kept my Lego. And so when my kids came along, she's like, well, you better have your junk back, and gave me my Lego back. And I'm like, I remember this. How awesome is this? How much fun? And I started sort of playing again back when my kids came along. So I had a very lengthy period of no Lego. We call that the dark ages. So I had quite a dark age.
in order to become a certified Lego professional, what are the steps that you go through? And again, you know, obviously then playing with your own children, but at what stage do you actually think I can make a career out of this?
Yeah, like all good things like this, you can't go to university. You couldn't go to University of Sydney, for example, so you can get a degree in Legoology or anything along those lines. So, and you can't get a hex step either, by the way, in playing with Lego, as much as that would be okay. So one of those things kind of just happens by accident, where I was building some cool stuff, and I was playing mostly in the robotics field and doing a lot of work with sort of technology-based things. And I bumped into some folks from Lego, and they said, let's do some stuff together. And then we did a few more things and a few more things and a few more things. So kind of just morphed and evolved over a period of time. And eventually I got to the stage where I was working my normal job, sort of, you know, 8 to 10 hours a day, then doing the Lego for 8 to 10 hours a day, and then trying to sleep and raise a family for 8 to 10 hours a day. So something had to give.
Yeah.
And of course, the normal job was the thing that lost out in that equation.
So developing the persona of the brick man, sort of how's your career progressed? Because it's been a really interesting trajectory, hasn't it, in terms of both the commercial builds you've done, but then also the way that you work with museums, which is what we're going to talk about a little bit later on with this. But have you sort of found, was there a big game plan, or is a lot of this just sort of working organically?
Definitely no game plan. I think it was born out of, and like, you know, I'm sure your listeners can share this, you know, everyone has their own way of explaining it, but about doing something you love, and then figuring out at some point, how do you turn that something you love into paying the mortgage, which is the second goal in life that most people have. So it was around that and finding that common ground, and, you know, and it became, you know, I would do things, you know, make models for people that some would interest me, some wouldn't interest me. And obviously, as your career gets longer, I kind of put it similar to an artist. At first, if you think of, say, a Renaissance era painter, they have to paint a lot of rich people for a living, and that's what they did to earn their way and keep their keep. And then one month of the year, they might paint something that they want to paint. So it started off for me very much like that. I would be making Lego models for, you know, businesses, for corporates, you know, all, you know, architectural models, doing all those sorts of things. And then occasionally being able to afford to be able to make something that I would want to make and you know, go from there. And then obviously as time progresses and you do more and more of that kind of stuff and you get, you know, larger and larger and, you know, your business develops, you get more opportunities. So, yeah, it kind of happened like that, I guess.
Well, you know, and I guess sort of now over the last couple of years, and particularly during the lockdown periods as well, Lego Masters Australia, of course, has really cemented that idea of family viewing television, which kind of died for a bit as well.
Yeah.
Take us behind the scenes on the program. You know, how easy is it for you, or how difficult is it for you to judge the work of the competitors at times?
Yeah, look, it's interesting. Certainly, I was very nervous at the start of the show. I mean, no offense to television, but at times it gets a pretty bad rap in terms of reality television and you know, what that means to the average person. So we were really mindful that we wanted to create something that wasn't that and was really wholesome, and something that I remember, you know, I'm an old bloke nowadays, but back in the day, I remember as a family, we'd sit around and watch the same TV shows as a family, you know, and it was a thing that we did.
Yeah.
And the wonderful memories that created. So we kind of wanted to do that. That was sort of in our, you know, the back of our mind. And then, yeah, so basically, how do you then turn that into something? So basically, it comes down to that. And because of that, that then reflects the way that which we interact with our contestants. You know, we're very positive and mindful that they're, you know, they're working their butts off and they're working really hard and making incredible things. And we want to be as supportive as we possibly can for that process to happen. So that kind of sets the tone, I guess, for trying to be as wholesome as we can.
It's interesting because it nicely reflects also the parallel that we'll talk about a little bit later on, but the role of Lego within museums, because again, it's that opportunity for kids, parents, grandparents to actually all engage with the one thing at the same time, isn't it? That you may not necessarily get looking at an actual display of, you know, antiquities or contemporary art or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, and look, this is a really interesting thing, and it's probably one of the main reasons why we've done so much work together, you know, museum over the years. History is the greatest storyteller of all time. The stories that history tells us are incredible, sometimes unbelievable, sometimes fantastical, all of those wonderful things. And Lego is just a storytelling medium. It just happens to be in one which resonates primarily with children, but obviously adults as well. And so it gives us the ability to tell these amazing and incredible and in-depth stories in a fun, cool way. And it whether it's an, you know, an introduction into that world, and then it encourages children to explore and develop, you know, what they're thinking from there on. But for me as a medium, I can have a lot of fun with it, and I get to tell those stories too.
And to insert some of your own stories too over the years.
Which well, I do have a bit of a sense of humour that I do like to slide in there too. So, you know, yeah.
We might talk about Darth Vader and some of the others a little bit later on as we go along. But I guess what's interesting is you know, what's the number one question you get asked by kids, or indeed adult Lego fans for that matter? Is there sort of one thing that people constantly ask you, or is it quite varied depending upon the build you're working on?
No, it's always, how do I get your job? That's the number one. That's the number one thing. I have a very aspirational role, so, you know, I totally empathize and understand and get that. So yeah, probably that's number one. And then probably not far behind that is, you know, how do you make these things? Where do you come up with the ideas? You know, how do you sort of develop and work with that sort of stuff? And that's, there's no simple answer to that question, because ideas come in so many different places in so many ways. And, you know, it could be from reading a book, from watching a movie, from listening to a you know, music, could be traveling somewhere exotic, could be lots of different places. So, you know, ideas come in, they don't come with a bow around them at your doorstep.
Look, I know all of our children are always all of our favourites, but over the years, is there any one particular build that you're most proud of?
You know, this is going to sound super corny, this is the same answer that I give to everybody. So you can take great solace in this. It's the Colosseum, which we made together back in the day. For a number of reasons, very different reasons.
Yeah.
First off, from a technically challenging perspective, to make an oval out of square bricks and rectangular bricks is very difficult. And so the things that I learned back then, I've used multiple times in other projects.
Right.
So for example's sake, when I had to make the MCG out of Lego, modern day Colosseum, I had to use those same techniques. So it actually taught me a lot from that. You know, Lego perspective. So I think of that back fondly as well. And also I think some of the reactions that when that Lego model went live from people really blew me away and are really funny and hilarious. So I always look very fondly at the Colosseum.
No, so do we. So, look, well, that actually nicely segues into my next set of questions, because really I want us to focus, the next few questions on the various projects that you've done with the Nicholson Museum at the University of Sydney originally and now with the Chow Chek Wing Museum. Can we begin about the current Lego build of yours, which is on display at the Chow Chek Wing Museum up until the end of January 2023, the Lego Tutankhamun? Could you describe to us the process from how you and I first talked about the idea of maybe we should do something to mark the centenary of Tutankhamun's discovery through to the final completion? What type of research do you put into a build?
Yeah, look, this is really interesting. And the subject matter, I won't say it's irrelevant, but some subjects are obviously easier to research than others. And fortunately, very well documented subject matter. So it gave us the ability to be able to understand and learn about the subject matter. The more you understand what it is you are trying to build, and even the feelings, the emotions, the stories behind it, the whys, the hows, all of those, myriad of questions, by asking and answering those questions, you'll get a better feel for what the Lego model should be about, and what it's trying to portray, and the why it exists, which is probably the most important question that you should ask when making something like this. So that was the first bonus gift, if you like, that allowed us to be able to do that. And then obviously we need to think about, well, who's the audience too? Who's it, who's this for? What is it? It's obviously an artist's interpretation of it. It's not, we can't create the exact replica because we're constrained using plastic bricks and things like that. So, so we go through a bit of a process of how we're going to approach this. What does it look like from our perspective? Are we, in our artist rendition, are we going a little bit cartoony? Are we going a little bit stereotypical? Where do we sort of sit in all these things? And so our team internally go through a bit of a brainstorming session where we try and answer all of those questions ourselves.
Yep.
And, we came back to you with a myriad of questions. I do apologize profusely for asking so many questions of you, but that helps us, and that allows us to come up with what we come up with.
I mean, one thing, reflecting, we talked about all the different types of objects recovered from the tomb that we could have done, and, of course, the final selection was the lid of the middle coffin of Tutankhamun. But one thing I find striking at it that I didn't even think of at the time we were having those conversations is the face must have been actually quite tricky to capture on that size and scale, because it is life size, or slightly larger than life size, isn't it?
Yeah. So two things about that. From a Lego perspective, making people's faces, if you were to just make a very generic bland face, that's a relatively easy thing to do. A couple of eyes, nose, mouth, there you go. If you want to make a face that looks like a very particular person and the characteristics of that person, that is a much more difficult beast and is really quite difficult. Throw on top of that, if you were to look at the real tomb, and the middle one, it's a stylized version of a face. It's not, so then we've got to capture not only that, but their version of how they stylized the face.
Yeah.
Through the same time period. So it's kind of like a layered approach on top of it. And then, of course, we have all of the vagaries of specific Lego parts can only do certain things, and we've only got certain shapes we can use it and the rest. So, it provided us a few challenges. And even things like, the cosmetic appearance which they chose, and that, very distinct style that they use. That provides challenges. How do we achieve that? How do we, how do we work through that too?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. One thing, and I think you've actually commented upon this as well, but the color was an interesting one. I thought of the middle coffin because it has, the real one has lapis lazuli and other elements to break up the gold, unlike the outer and inner coffin, which are, one's wood with gold plate and the other is pure gold. So I thought, a sea of gold brick yellow Lego would be a little overwhelming, but there's still a lot of gold in there. I mean, how do you try and capture colors and things like that within the palette? Can you actually go to Lego and ask them to create a different color? Or
I'm opening a big can of worms here, so I'll try and keep it as short as I possibly can, but great, it's an awesome question. So first off, Lego has around about 60 colors, okay? Right. But not every element comes in every color. So, right. For example, say a white Lego brick or a gray Lego brick or a black Lego brick or a brown Lego brick, really common and comes in most pieces. A color like gold, for example, comes in very few Lego elements, and it'll come in really strange parts, like it might be a minifigure's legs or a sword or a car's headlight or these really unusual sorts of pieces, which to us, when we're trying to create a beautiful sculpture like this, we're like, that's not really going to work for us. So the color that we actually chose to represent the gold is actually quite a bright yellow, which allowed us to have enough creativity and you know, different parts of the palette with which to be able to do it to represent and style that. So we have to make these choices. This is the joy of Lego, is that we have all these restraints and restrictions placed upon us, yet we're still able to create. And that's the wonder of Lego, is that people go, that's just the plain old Lego brick. How did you do that?
How did you do that?
So that's kind of how we solve the riddle.
You're listening to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. My guest this episode is the Brickman, Ryan McNaught. Now, Ryan, Lego Tutankhamun is, of course, the fifth creation of yours to come to the University of Sydney, and we've worked with you since 2011, I think, was the first one, if I've got the date right.
Yeah, let's not show our age, Greg.
That's okay. But I'd like just to ask you, and you mentioned the Colosseum before, but I'd like just to ask your memories and reflections on some of those builds over the years. I guess, firstly, how did you come to work with the Nicholson Museum in the first place?
Yeah, look, it was really interesting. At the time, our great friend, Michael Turner from Museums History, he reached out to me and said, I think you've been or seen some work that I've done somewhere. I think it was part of like one of Lego's birthday celebrations that they had at the time. And I think he reached out and said, look, can we do something along those lines? And we got into quite a dialogue and we started going down that way. So I think that was how the introduction sort of happened. And then what I think was the most pleasantly surprising for everybody is after we put the Colosseum in the old building, as it were, just how popular it was. And it kind of opened everybody's eyes a little bit to, wow, this is just a great medium to let people introduce and discover. And at the time, and please don't take offense to this, I called it Sydney's greatest hidden treasure, was the Nicholson Museum at the time.
Yeah.
And so it was a way for people to discover and find the museum and all of its richness and all of the wonders that it encased. So it was quite an entree.
Well, you're absolutely right, because that was part of the rationale from the museum's perspective. And Michael Turner, who was the senior curator of the old Nicholson Museum back in the time, very much wanted to increase audience numbers and expectations, and breaking that idea of a university museum just being for the university community. And we certainly thought that reaching out to children would be a great way to do it. I've written papers about this as well, but really, as you've talked about before, from a museum's perspective, these replicas in Lego, it's really just a 21st century version of a tradition of dioramas and plaster casts and corkboard casts going back to the 17th century in European museums as well. So it was kind of fascinating to see the kids coming in to look at your work, but then actually staying to see the rest of the museum.
And that's exactly it, because, I mean, I remember when I was a young child and I went to museums and I did see those dioramas and plaster cast models and incredible things, and they captivated me, just that the medium is slightly more updated for the 21st century, I guess. That's probably the easy rationale.
And something that you can, you know, whilst we will probably never sit at home and build our own Lego Colosseum, but those of us who are kids and those of us with kids all have our Lego collections at home. So there's always that sense of, I can go and try and do that, which you can't necessarily do when you see a diorama at a history museum.
Not easily.
not without lots of training and skill. Yeah, you talked before about sort of the challenges of the Lego Colosseum. Do you have any other outstanding memories from that particular build?
I do. Probably the one that makes me laugh the most is after the Colosseum was made and it went on display, for some period of time, I got an email from an Italian Lego fan who was, at that stage, no one had ever made a Colosseum that big before out of Lego. And they were like, oh, wow, this is amazing. But they were actually really upset that an Italian hadn't made it and that it was an Australian person that had made it. Very, you know, parochial that they are, and very passionate about what they do. So I did have a bit of a laugh at that story. So what I did do as a tribute to our great Italian friends is that I added a couple more minifigures onto the model. I put a gladiator charging €50 for a photo. So much like the real Colosseum. So, yeah.
I mean, one of my outstanding memories is the number of questions that we used to get from visitors and from school kids and so on, particularly about the Popemobile as well.
Yes.
One of the lovely little vignettes you added on. So it's interesting sort of seeing what people would focus in on as well. And I imagine you see that with many of your other builds.
Yeah, I do. And one thing that I really love about the Colosseum as well is, I mean, we did the half-half. So we did the half as it was in its prime, and then obviously the half as the ruin today. And it really was a good contrast and showed people, you know, what's happened over time and about what it used to look like in its prime and how great and grand and such a huge thing it was. So I think, you know, when you put in storytelling like that, it adds a lot of value, I guess.
It does. It certainly does. Now, the next project we worked on together was the Lego Acropolis. And, of course, it is now currently on display in the Acropolis Museum in Athens, in Greece, which is quite remarkable as well when you think about it. What were some of the challenges with that particular project?
Well, just before I answer that, it has the best view. It actually looks out over the Acropolis itself. So the Lego model every day has the most beautiful view in all of Greece. So I'm very jealous of it, I must say. Look, this is kind of the same, a bit of a theory that we've adapted to all of our Lego models, is what we did is we collated, well, when I say we, you know, yourself in particular, collated a list of, you know, 30 to 40 interesting things that have happened over a period of time of the life of the subject matter. For example, like the Acropolis. What were things that, you know, made the Acropolis? And so what we did is not only did we make the physical being of the Acropolis, but we told those stories in all those vignettes that have happened over the period of time, you know, throughout that, you know, whether it be, you know, the play that's playing in the amphitheater or you know, all of these, you know, incredible, the Billy Joel concert, I think.
Yes.
So all of these kind of little stories, they allowed us not only to research and to tell the story as much as we possibly can, but to bring life to these models as well. It's okay just to have, here's the Acropolis, great, yes, here it is, but here's all these incredible things happening at the same time, which we've compressed from thousands of years onto this one model. Yeah. You know, that's very unique.
You're absolutely right. That social history aspect as well of not just presenting a replica of the architecture, but actually how it was used and the changing nature of that as well was a lot of fun. And we picked up that as well with the Lego Pompeii that we'll come to in a moment. But it's had this wonderful second life in Greece itself, which is amazing.
Yeah, it is. And it's funny, I occasionally, it's like an old friend that comes to visit, I occasionally get pinged from somebody on Instagram or something or other saying, we saw it and we saw the model and, yeah, so it's really quite lovely.
Oh, nice. Lego Pompeii we did in 2015 and it's still on display in the museum today. It's the model that we took from the old Nicholson space into the Chowchak Wing Museum when we opened in 2020. What do you recall from that construction? That was quite a challenging one, wasn't it? There was a lot of elements.
It is. There's two parts to it that made it hard. Is first off is the topography, is creating the terrain of which the city was built, and also hiding underneath the secret, of course, of what was happening unbeknownst to the participants on top of the model. And so before we even laid a brick on top of, you know, what is the story of Pompeii, was creating all of that landscape. So there was a lot of, I call it grunt work, for lack of a better term, of setting that out before we're able to have fun and recreate all the interesting things that were on the top as well. And I think, and it's interesting, I remember reading Mary's books incredibly detailed, you know, trying to gain insight into what Pompeii was like at the time and trying to gain insight into how to create that and the lifestyle that they lived and all of those kind of things. And so it's things like, you know, the baths and this kind of interesting stuff that we added in that I hadn't in any previous model, just to get that sense of, I won't say everyday life because it was a bit of an unusual city in that regard, but, you know, the life of a Pompeian at the time.
And I remember there were things like the wall paintings and so on, which, you know, try to do sort of, obviously Lego is three-dimensional, but try to do representations of both angles must have been really I suspect I probably caused you some nightmares when I sort of said, oh, and we need to put wall paintings in and things like that.
And even the pottery and important things like that at that scale is really quite difficult and challenging. So hopefully we did it justice.
Well, look, it's been beloved by many, many thousands, tens of thousands of visitors and by school kids because, of course, in New South Wales, Pompeii is a core component of studying ancient history at school. I mean, we talked before about that addition of the vignettes and the narratives within the broader model. That particular one, of course, now has three, the architecture itself, the history of archaeology and investigations, and then also the way Pompeii's turned up in pop culture. Oh. So, you know, you put in a TARDIS, for example, from the episode of Doctor Who, and Professor Mary Beard and some of the more famous popularizers of Pompeii in popular culture and in fiction and in documentaries and so on. So any particular one that stands out in your mind?
Well, I guess for me, it's probably, I mean, reading Mary's books and you know, because I think, you know, from her perspective, was it the Colosseum or the Acropolis? I think it was the Acropolis where I read her books on that as well. And her style, obviously she has a very distinct style in the way she writes. And, you know, putting a bicycle in there and things like that as well, of course, there are all those sort of little fun parts. So from my perspective, and, you know, I'm a bit of a refugee from the 80s. So I certainly remember that episode with Doctor Who when he arrived and things like that. So I think being able to put that in there, I won't say it adds relevance, but it adds relevance to me anyway.
Yeah. No, I think it does add relevance. And by the way, Mary Beard, until she retired very recently, had the Lego face as her profile on the Cambridge University website as well. So, again, she was extremely excited about being represented in Lego form.
Oh, that's awesome.
And also, you talk about getting old. I must say it's fascinating taking school kids around to know all about the riots in the amphitheatre of Pompeii in 69 AD, but look at Pink Floyd, who were also incorporated in the model, and look as if that, you know, rock band is ancient history. So I always find that quite challenging when it's like, talk to your dad.
Yeah, your dad will know what the answer is there,
Now, of course, it's not just the models for the Chow Chak Wing Museum, but over the years now you've worked with many different Australian museums and galleries. Could you just sort of talk a bit about some of the shows and how you've designed and how they've been received in some of the different places? I know you've got an exhibition coming up at the Australian National Maritime Museum here in Sydney next year, for example. How do you work with cultural institutions?
Yeah, look, it's really interesting. There's a couple of different components to that. First off, we worked with what used to be the old Historic Houses Trust in Sydney, but now the Museum of Sydney was Towers of Tomorrow, where we focused on architecture and modern buildings and what they deliver. And that was an incredible project where, you know, I learned so much about that space and about what that was doing in society and how that changed. So we made a great exhibition there together, which is toured not only Australia, but is in the US as well. And then the one you're referring to is called Brickwrecks, which is about shipwrecks, predominantly in Australia. There are a few overseas which tell incredible stories as well about, you know, maritime history and in particular focusing on wrecks and what they were able to tell us about how far humanity come from a maritime perspective. And so working on some of those models was super crazy too. Many of them have super unique challenges that you think to yourself, I don't know how I'm going to do that. I'm like, oh, but you do manage to find a way somehow or another anyway. And also even to the point of, you know, talking about ecological disaster and you know, the responsibility that we have as people to look after the planet. So when you're working on projects like that, it's, they're interesting. And, I mean, museums and universities exist for one reason, is for people to learn and to teach people. And whilst I'm still learning, then I'm engaged in whatever it is that I'm building or working on. And I think that's the important part of what these processes do. So as I'm learning, I'm on board with whatever it is I'm making.
So as a content creator, when you're walking around a museum that has, you know, one of your Lego builds in it alongside, you know, other cultural artifacts or other artistic or scientific material, how does that make you feel?
It's weird. there's two parts to it. I always enjoy watching people's reactions. And so, you know, getting joy and satisfaction out of the fact that hopefully I've managed to engage someone in can potentially be, you know, a very detailed or in-depth subject matter. So that's always really refreshing and interesting. And then I also, their feedback. Are they interested in this? Are they interested in that? So I'm always kind of in that feedback loop of thinking, what could I do better or what could I do differently or whatever. Yeah. And then the second part, which is probably the most interesting to me, is what is on display around it. And the what is on display around it is often, you know, for me, having made the Lego model, understanding it very well, often more exciting because I'm like, oh, now what if I did that? Or what if I could add that to that? Or what if I could do this? Or you know, those kind of things. So yeah. And then what's really interesting is I'm very lucky enough to have traveled quite a bit, and I go to a lot of museums and galleries that obviously don't see Lego as part of their, you know, that's not who they are. And that's okay. Yeah. Not, this is not a right or wrong conversation. But I think to myself, I can only imagine if I was to get something into a museum that hasn't embraced that, what that would do to their mindset and change it. And a really good example of that is the Art Institute of Chicago, which is one of my favorite galleries / museums in the world and has all these incredible things that I really love to look at and watch. And I think to myself, imagine if I was to get something in there one day. So I always think about that kind of stuff too, you know, the what ifs.
Maybe a Lego Mona Lisa in the Louvre.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure if they're up for it or not, but maybe I need to aim a bit lower. I mean, the Met in New York would be lovely too, or the Guggenheim. Maybe if I could try and get something in there one day, perhaps, who knows?
You never know, right? You never know. Yeah. What are some of the projects you've got coming up? We just talked about the show at the Maritime Museum. You're currently filming another season of Lego Masters Australia, but what else is on the cards?
Yeah, we also recently finished our pandemic project, which we all got locked away. Being Melbourne based, of course, we were locked up for a period of time, but that's good for us because that means we get to do lots of Lego. Yeah. So we saw it very much as a positive. So we made our Jurassic World. We made a lot of dinosaurs in that lockdown, which is something we've never done before. And that again is a whole other form of science and learnings. So so we made a lot of dinosaurs, which is a lot of fun. We also created a little exhibition. It's a little bit of a baby one. We call it Bricktionary, which is the A to Z of interesting Lego things. And that's currently in the Museum of Melbourne, actually.
Oh, great.
Down there. Not far from Farlap, actually. Australia's great Farlap. I haven't made Farlap out of Lego yet, but maybe one day I will.
You can make part. It's big.
It's very big. And so that's more of an ideas scenario. So I'm not trying to teach, although we do teach particular techniques and interesting things and cool stuff. It's more about where do ideas come from and how do you get ideas? And that exhibition's more about that component. So it's more of a creative blanket, if that makes any sense, that we try and teach as opposed to a specific thing to learn about. So, yeah.
It must be interesting getting some of those sort of cross-comparative things as well because, you know, the alphabet really frees you up to kind of do whatever you want in many ways, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And things like, you know, so for example, like you're able to play with pop culture, you know, R is for robot, for example, sake, or whatever, you know. A is for archaeology. And, you know, we have a little bit around that. So we're able to slice in lots of different and interesting things. And what I have learned in my time, particularly been working with a lot of kids, is every child's different. So what, you know, a robot might be interested for a very particular child. Some other children have no interest in robots whatsoever, and it might be about a tree for them or whatever the case happens to be. So the alphabet allows you to really go quite broad in that sense.
If there were no limitations whatsoever, are there any museum displays you'd like to do in future? Are there any ancient sites that we haven't done that you'd like to have a go at?
I think there's plenty, actually. Predominantly if I think about my personal interests, and so this puts a bias on things, of course, I'm not suggesting that they're in any way preferential or whatever, but I mean, I've never really seen much done from a Mayan or an Aztec perspective. I think that is the incredible storytelling potential and natural beauty and wonder as well. So I'm very much interested in perhaps something in that South American history as well.
Yeah.
And likewise, medieval times. I don't think we've focused too much from, you know, everyone will often play around with castles or whatever the case happens to be, but certainly from a medieval perspective, there's some incredible storytelling from that perspective too. So a couple of very different ones.
Yeah, maybe a Lego Notre Dame Cathedral or something like that.
Well, obviously they're quite rebuilding theirs at the moment, so maybe we can beat them to the punch, perhaps. Yeah.
Final question, Ryan. When we have visitors to the Chow Chak Wing Museum and they have an opportunity to see Lego Tutankhamun and Lego Pompeii, which will continue to be on display for quite some time to come, what would you like them to think about when they're viewing your handiwork?
Not so much. I mean, the Lego is one thing to think about, and, you know, that's great that they do and understand that. But what I hope that it does is that it, you know, Lego is a modern medium. It's a, you know, it's only been around for, you know, sort of 80 years, and that's what we know and understand. is to maybe think about at that point in time when the real one was being made, of what those materials were and the complexities involved and the artistry and the craftspersonship of the time to create what it was. I can only imagine the team of people that had to make the real one. Yeah. And the pressure yeah. that they were under
yeah.
and the prestige that they would be gaining from doing what they were doing and the years that it would take to make and the, getting the materials alone and the story of getting Raining. The materials
yeah.
is mind-blowing. So when you open that kind of thought pattern alone, that kind of makes you think about a million different things and you can really get lost in that. So that would be something I'd love people to think about.
Well, thank you very much, Ryan. I would like, on behalf of all the visitors that have given us comments here at the Chow Chak Wing Museum over the years, just to pass on how much joy you've brought to them, how much joy you've brought to my son, and also how much joy you've brought to me as well. I've had such a ball doing the research for the various projects over the years with you as well. So thank you very much for your time. I know how busy you are at the moment, so I very much appreciate you appearing on Object Matters.
Thank you so much for having me, Craig, and for letting me display Lego with you. And I can't wait to work on the next one.
We'll be in touch. Thank you, Ryan.
All right, excuse me, mate.
Object Matters is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The Chow Chak Wing Museum and the University of Sydney wishes to pay our respect to the traditional custodians and acknowledge their close connection with land.
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chow Chak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, Muse Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.